research project.
Thanks, Hans.
Nadia.
Thank you. This morning, good morning, everyone, first of all. This morning, I'm presenting staff paper 16, IFRS 2 research project, report on research so far. There are currently 13 research projects on the board's agenda. 8 of them are classified as being at the assessment stage. Complexity of IFRS 2 is one of those projects. This topic was added to the agenda after the last agenda consultation in 2012. This research project is unusual because it doesn't deal with a specific accounting issue, like, for example, impairment of goodwill, nor does it deal with a set of specific transactions, like, for example, pollutant pricing mechanisms. Instead, it deals with the broad application issue of the entire standard. In this sense, dealing with this project was like dealing with a person who keeps saying that he's unwell without revealing much information. How do you make a diagnosis? Well, you still need to identify the symptoms. In the context of this research project, we started our analysis with looking at application issues that arise in practice. We spoke to preparers of financial statements and also to accounting experts who deal with share-based payment transactions on a daily basis. The first finding of this outreach was about the complexity of share-based payment arrangements themselves. The complexity of transactions adds significantly to the perception that IFRS 2 is a complex standard. The next second finding of our research relates to accounting. The finding was derived from the analysis of the main application issues that were identified during the outreach. The identified application issues are summarized on page 16 of the paper. As you can see from this summary, most of the application issues stem from the two measurement models that currently exist in IFRS 2, excuse me, for share-based payment transactions with employees. More specifically, the most significant number of application issues arises from the grant date fair value measurement model in IFRS 2. On the basis of these findings, we then looked at the potential way forward for this research project. There are four of them. A post-implementation review, further research on the grant date fair value measurement model, narrow scope amendments to IFRS 2, or discontinuance of the project. For the second potential way forward, which is further research, we also included several potential solutions or alternatives to the existing grant date fair value measurement model. Strictly speaking, this perhaps goes beyond the assessment stage of a research project. But after some internal consultation, we believe that providing you with this information would provide you with a more complete picture of the entire issue. I'm approaching the end of my introduction, and at this stage, I would like to make two final points. Firstly, based on our limited research, it appears that share-based payment transactions continue to be common in practice. Many entities continue to have them. And secondly, this is a process-related point. You are not required to make any decisions about the future of this project today. You will make the final decision after the current agenda consultation in 2016. At that stage, you will have the findings of this research, any further research findings, in case you believe today that more work is required, and finally, you'll have responses to the agenda consultation from the constituents. All this information will hopefully help you to make an informed decision about the future of this project next year. And that's the introduction.
Can I ask a question? Just to kick it off, thanks for the very good paper, and thank you for the examples that you gave us to work through too. I found them very helpful indeed. In paragraph 53, which you took us to on page 16, the first problem that's identified is that there are two models. Now, I'm trying to work out in my mind what's the problem with that. Is that because it's hard to work out which transactions go into which model, i.e. which are cash settled and which are not, or that it makes it hard for users because it gives two different types of results, or what is the real problem having two models?
I think it is for users as well as for preparers, because you have share-based payment arrangements and you have to account for them in a completely different way and just getting your mind around this, you know, because they're two completely different concepts. And for users as well, basically, users did perceive this very complex standard because it just was difficult to comprehend what the grant date fair value measurement model was. So it's not just, it's not about classification. It is about just getting your mind around to completely different things.
Okay,
for, for similar transactions.
Yeah, so it's really understanding the results that you get, which are based on two different quotes.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Amaro?
Thank you. It's the same paragraph as Ian. By the way, it's an excellent summary of the issue. And I maybe questions or comments. When I go through the reasons on the application issue here, I think the origin is exactly because we identify two types of settlements, cash or equity. Since we had these two and we decided to have the equity ones into equity, and because of the associated issues of remeasuring equity components, so we have inevitably all the problems associated with that. We will discuss further after this the amendments proposed by the interpretation committee. Most of them are clarifications, I would say, in my view. So I'm wondering here, considering your four ways forward, and I agree with you, we should, because we had a number of amendments already, we should wait for the agenda consultation because it's natural. I think it's wise for us to wait for them. But the only way I see really to proceed is to eventually revisit this, because as it is today, the conceptual framework, if we keep the distinction between equity and cash settled, will be somewhat difficult for us to overcome the issue of measurement after the granted day. So I was is this your perception as well as staff and Peter considering the conceptual framework, or am I simplifying too much the issues that you are bringing to us here?
First of all, I think it is a little bit difficult to predict the outcome of the debt equity project at the moment. And then, like, when it does come out, I guess we'll have to regroup and have another discussion. It's just too many contingencies at the moment, I think.
I'm not actually asking about the prediction of the outcome, but your perception as a staff is if my perception is adequate or not. So the origin of most of the problems, at least identified here, is exactly the separation between equity and cash settled, and the outcome in terms of classification as liability or equity.
I think the way the IFRS 2 is written today, yes, that's the reason why it is like that. Yes.
Maybe I should add a couple of comments to that, and it follows on in a way from Ian's point question about the two models. The thing I found most striking when Nadia started to give us the results of this were that there are two sides to the transaction. There's a credit side and there's a debit side. And the debit side is all about employee expenses, and so the natural question is, does that look similar to what we're doing in IS 19? And if it's different, why is it different? And on the credit side, of course, it's the liability equity question. And the two models are strikingly different at the moment, because one of them is a kind of frozen measurement and one of them is a full remeasurement. Mm-hmm. So
one of them is a what?
And one of them is a full remeasurement.
No, the first one?
It's frozen measurement. It's basically frozen.
Yeah,
there's some updating, but it's basically frozen. And if you compare it with pensions, the striking thing is for pensions we separate out a service cost component and a remeasurement component. But we don't do that in IFRS 2 for whatever reason. It's not entirely clear to me why we don't do that in IFRS 2. And then I think some of the answers to specific issues with IFRS 2 are driven a bit by that conclusion that there's kind of a single expense and the board wanted to get an expense in. I don't know whether it would necessarily have reached the same answers if it had separated a service cost component and a remeasurement component. And then on the equity side, of course, there's the question we discussed in the conceptual framework a couple of years ago, which is that if we have more than one class of instrument classified in equity, then we don't give people much information about the different classes of instrument. And so we've discussed various ways we might try and remedy that. We had the idea in the discussion paper of, for example, remeasuring equity instruments within equity, but that, you know, there's a way to go still on the liability equity project. So it seems to me that one way to bring the models a bit closer together would actually be to focus a bit more on what we classify on the debit side and maybe split out service cost and remeasurement components, and on the equity side look at whether there's ways of giving more information about the current value of equity instruments classified there. And if we did either of those, we might bring the two models a bit closer together. They might not necessarily end up in exactly the same place, but that you might not get quite such a stark division between the two models if we explored something like that.
Peter, on that.
Sue? Oh. Yeah, I was going to say something similar, so that's why I sort of tried to push in. Firstly, I think it's a really good paper. I think it's a really complicated area, and you managed to make it very accessible, and that's not an easy thing to do. So
an achievement.
So well done. That's an achievement in itself. I think that in terms of next steps, whatever we would do, I think we should. It's interesting to hear what we hear in the agenda consultation in terms of urgency, but whatever we do, I think we shouldn't rush into assuming that we've got that we should sort of be patching up exactly what we've got now. But for me, I think we need to take a little bit of a step back, and it sort of builds a little bit on what Peter was saying, because what really struck me, if you look at the table on page 20 of these sort of different approaches that we've started to sort of flesh out as different ways of thinking about things, the thing that really struck me was how different the expense column is. And so you get a completely different expense profile because of what we're doing on the credit side. And if you go back and read the basis to IFRS 2, what really struck me, which I'd never really appreciated before, was how much the decisions on grant date measurement weren't driven because it was equity settled, but because they'd decided that the service cost measurement should be frozen, to use your term, and kept at the 30. But it seemed that, at least in the basis, there's no real consideration of why they didn't also think that the expense should have been 30, even if it was liability settled, cash settled, with some sort of other line item going on. And so I think it would be good for us to take a step back and try and work out what we think our anchor is. So what's the number that we want as our anchor for what we're shooting for? And if, and I don't know if we would, but if we decided that our anchor should be a measure of the expense based on what the value was at the date you got the service, that would change the way we might be able to think about the other side of the balance sheet, and it would actually take a little bit of the tension off it being so close to a debt equity project. And I think that might be a good place to start. Maybe we'd end up with the same end answer we've got now, but at least I think we need to go through that thinking process.
I think this is a very good point, actually, because people kind of instinctively link this project immediately to debt equity, but like as discussion shows, what Peter said and what you're saying, it's quite a lot about it. It's about the debit.
It's quite odd if you think about it that you're getting the same service, but just because you decided whether to give somebody shares or cash, you get a completely different expense number.
People tend to look at these transactions through the debt equity lens, but like as our discussion shows, there's quite a lot more to it than just that equity.
I wanted just to ask Peter, the remeasurement in equity, the problem is that those shares granted to employees are the same kind of shares as any other shares.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to measure that class of shares in comparison to the normal or usual class of shares doesn't make sense to me, because just the only difference is there is they are granted before they are issued. But otherwise, when they are issued, they're just the same. So what kind of things would you remeasure here?
Yeah, and I wouldn't advocate doing something differently for equity instruments because they're issued to employees. I mean, I think that would be part of the larger work we're doing in liabilities equity. And I think Emmanuel's been saying consistently through that project that if we have more than one class of equity instrument, we need to think about giving the best way to give information about that.
But it's only one class of equity instrument, that's the problem.
Mary?
Several comments, and One, let me go back to Nadia's opening remarks and saying it's like being a doctor and the patient just says I'm ill and doesn't give symptoms. In some ways, I think this paper might, I'll say it's therapy in terms of everybody getting to say what the problems are, and actually Nadia being tasked with collecting and analyzing, everybody saying here's what the problems are. And well, I think that it, again, echo the comments about a very good, clear paper that sets things out. Whenever you put a problem in front of a bunch of people, we all start talking about how to solve it and where the starting point should be. And I think we have to remember that one of the basic questions of research is, should we be solving this problem, having identified it? And although I have a lot of history with IFRS 2, it isn't. I don't think I'm fighting for the status quo. What I am saying is, our reaction to comments over the years about the complexity, the number of changes, et cetera, may be lagging far enough that if we start, that most of the things may have worked their way through the system. I agree with Amaro's observation at the beginning in terms of if we are going to solve, the concerns about complexity, then I think it would be going back and looking something as fundamental as do we need two models. And I also take Sue's point, and some of Peter's observations, that it really goes back to what is the anchor, the starting point, because remember when IFRS 2 was developed, there were a lot of arguments about whether if you settle in shares, there should be any expense. So we really was starting from arguments around debt equity, and I think Sue's idea of where we would start would be a good one. If we decided that we wanted to address this, for me, I do not see any further research that we should ask the staff to do at this time. I think one of the lessons out of this is this kind of paper is very helpful to us in terms of having a base to then bring in the input from the agenda consultation. I think for future agenda consultations, maybe having a target of getting papers like these out more at the time that the consultation starts rather than completes would be helpful to also inform stakeholders. That's not a criticism of the timing of this. It's just saying it's a lesson learned, because I think this helps everybody who's involved. And then a couple, I have a couple techie comments that I can pass on in this paper in terms of memorializing thoughts and issues. One is if you one of the things you explore is intrinsic value, and I'm assuming that just so we don't get people excited about the idea of going way back in time, you're saying intrinsic value remeasured through settlement. And the last thing is you give a brief overview of what the FASB is doing. I think when you bring this back to us maybe with the agenda consult responses, I'd say if we could get an update on what FASB is doing at that time, that'd be helpful. I think it's not just if they're reconsidering any principles, but also whether in their simplification work, if they are creating exceptions to any of the principles that are aligned would be the other piece I'd like to know. But good work. I think this captures everything, and this leaves me saying, let's wait to get the agenda consult and see if that adds anything new and kind of readjust what we've heard in the past about you need to address the complexity, because my sense is that those calls are fading as things have stabilized.
Gary?
Yeah, thank you. Also, Nadia, echo everyone else, this is an outstanding paper. It really was, and covered a lot of ground.
I think my both advisors, and Peter and Manuel, is not here today. Thank you.
I would agree with the punchline for today is probably no need for much further work or any further work now. See what agenda consultation brings. But I did note in there you said the last agenda consultation did not have this as a high priority item. But anyway, I got a bunch of comments scattered through it, and my biases will come out with the type of questions I'm going to ask it, which you know what they are. In paragraph 9, and Ian started, so I think the complexity is not the two models. I think people know which fork in the road, shared master cash settled plans, they need to go down. So that might make for a longer document, and maybe you could reorder stuff in there or something, but that in itself is not the complexity, and I do agree with you. The grant date, that how you apply the grant date, et accounting is the complexity. But, and I think Mary observed it, but as I read paragraphs 26 and later on paragraph 60, they kind of both make the point is there's not much issues in the pipeline, and that maybe for better or worse, one or the other, the complexity has resolved itself. And that was my first observation in there, you know, which is sort of bring me to my punchline, given where we are. Do we have a solution in search of a problem? You know, is kind of where my mindset is. I'm not so sure. And again, given based on paragraphs 26 and 60, it kind of says there's seems to work itself out at this point. And they, another comment, it's, you could look at it, you know, paragraph, start of paragraph 12. I inclined to think in general it is a relatively small charge of expense. Now, granted that part of that's because it's grant date, and the view would be it should, maybe should be a higher number, but, you know, given the recorded numbers what they are. But, and I do agree it's a significant amount of attention, but it's really at the senior executive ranks. It's not so much the rank and file plans. And so I would submit, I mean, that itch could be solved with disclosure of the options given to officers or senior executive officers, the board, you know, the number of awards and its fair value at any balance sheet date, or it's in the money position or something like that. That could be, if the itch really is dealing with key management personnel, that could be solved by disclosure. I do think, though, if you go way, way back to page 41, is going to be paragraph C3B when you get the range of expense going from 0.16 of a percent up to 12%. If we're going to go further, I think that number, let's say page 41.
Appendix C.
Appendix C, it'd be paragraph C3B.
Yep.
You got a huge range of expense. And I think we need something of a Pareto. That has to be, I mean, I'm inclined to think the most typical numbers are at the low end. You know, the 12% is the outlier, but I think that would need to be, you know, drilled down, you know, or dissected more, the bigger sampling you need, you know, percentage of companies in 0 to 1%, 1 to 2%. But if I read this, this is both grant date and cash settled and reporting date values. So whatever this would tell us, the grant date number is a subset of these, and maybe it's the majority, maybe it's, you know, 50-50, but, you know, again, I'm back to assuming my premise is right that you're near the low end of the range, and the problems are running themselves through the system in terms of implementation questions are back to, is this a solution really in search of a problem, you know, it at this point. And then my last comments on paragraph 36, which I actually completely agree with, I guess it'd be the interaction of 35 and 36, where the issue is in grant date accounting, some of the variables are updated for regular for reporting dates and some are not. And there's, I can assure you, having ran these programs, is what's investing or non-investing, a market, non-market, performance or a non-performance, what's a modification that increases value versus one that's a technical correction. That's where the root cause comes from. But if we're gonna leave grant data counting in, I think we would have to do a step back. Assuming you wanted to change grant data counting and or leave it in, you have to do a step back. I mean, absent dealing with those, you're never going to simplify this thing. Either you're going to have to accept that they exist and say that's life, and or the only other way to get it really is substantially the problem. But given the emotion that was attached to this thing during the mid-90s, the mid-2000s, and trust me, I wrote many comment letters to our colleagues on the other side saying these are not an expense, because if successful, you have an increase in cash and an increase in equity at the end of the day. And whether they produce it, that ship has sailed, but that's still a deeply viewed thing. Is the company doesn't disperse cash and share-based options, comes to the marketplace, and if successful, you've got more cash, you know, on your balance sheet than less. And that's a mindset I don't think can be penetrated. That's it. It's a very good paper. Doug?
Thank you. I'm on the same page with what Sue said. Actually, share-based payment has two transactions. One is receiving service. The other is issuing financial instrument. And these two transactions itself is completely different transaction. So if you measure the expense, if you measure what the service you have received, then the fair value measurement of grant date is variable. And it's frozen. I think it's okay. I think we should keep that concept. But on the other hand, we issued the financial instrument. Then we can leave it to the discussion of FICE. So for this project, we can concentrate on the expense side, not on the claim side or payment side. The problem of share-based payment is confusing those two transactions. And especially the argument like paragraph A7, which is page 25. And this is not 25, page 27. Yeah. So this is talking about amount of expense does not appear to reflect entity's result. Yes, to some extent it's true, but it's not because of the expense has moved. But it is because the fair value of the instrument you have issued have moved. So if the fair value of the financial instrument you have issued has moved, then that problem should be dealt with the FICE project, not in the IFRS 2 project. But however, this kind of concept is very common among the constituents, especially within the preparers. And the typical example is shown in paragraph A8 table, the third box, the typical example, underwater share option. So underwater share option, the fair value has declined. So eventually, you are not going to issue any share. So you only put the option, but because of the bad performance of the company, unfortunately, that employee didn't get any reward. So then the question is, why do we have to recognize expense? That is the question, and that many people say it's counterintuitive. But I don't think it's counterintuitive at all. Because you promised to pay something, and you agreed. You paid the option with the fair value at that time. Mm-hmm. So then you received the service in return of the consideration you have paid. Then you have to recognize expense anyway. And then the employee received options, and eventually he cannot exercise it. So it's a risk of the employee, not the risk of the issuers, not the risk of entities. So actually, this kind of argument is confusing two things completely. That causes a lot of tension and lots of difficulty of condition of IFRS 2. So like what is the vesting condition, non-vesting condition, everything. So if we can completely separate two things, then the IFRS 2 accounting would be much, much simpler.
Chang-Wu?
Thank you. I also have enjoyed this paper very, very much. It's a very good paper. There are generally, I agree with that these are all the discussions about as a the talk just said that these debits and credits are maybe independent event, but I don't think so. Sometimes it's very independent, but it seems to me if we see this kind of a transaction as a debit and credit, it looks like a kind of variable payment because this is depending on the stock price of their own equity entity. So that depends on this entity's own performance. So it's a kind of about their compensation cost and expense. We can separate this in the independent, but still, in another aspect, we can see this whole picture is a kind of variable payment, acquiring some labor cost, labor or some physical assets, the same thing. So their conditionality is very important in analyzing this issue. That's one thing. Another thing is the debt equity distinction. For example, I would like to suggest your analysis to be passed on their manual, because the manner of settlement was not considered in their gamma, beta, or all three approaches yet. They are just thinking about the amount, the independence of cash flows of the entity, and some kind of timing. But the manner of settlement was not considered there. So I don't think maybe you expect the result of that project quite be consistent with the IFRS 2. But based on your good analysis, you have a good implication on that issue too. So combine these ideas together, that's another suggestion. So very interesting, but this whole picture is quite complicated. So I would suggest look at these things more in a basic fundamental cash flow effect of the entity.
Maybe I could just comment on that interaction with liabilities equity, because it's always seemed to me strange that we'd have a different liability equity split in IFRS 2 versus IAS 32. Manuel's been fighting quite hard, I think, to sort of ring fence that project so that it's looking just at IAS 32. But I think inevitably we have to sort of consider the broader implications, and that might be a long-term thing to do, but I think we can't ignore that totally.
Ian? Yeah, just a couple of minor things. I also agree with your comments on post-implementation review. And you give us warning that maybe it wouldn't show up much and it would take a long time. And I also think we've got to think about the precedent. We've got to work out. I mean, we have this process for reviewing new standards, but we haven't ever discussed or tried to work out when we should go back to some of the old ones. Or if, yeah, that's right, what the principles should be. So before we head into any one, I think we should have the broader discussion on why we, which ones we would do or why we would do them, etc. So I think that was a good warning in the paper. And I just want to back up Peter's comments on the statement of changes in equity. I understand the problem you raised, Philippe, but I was always a supporter of that statement, and I thought our constituents weren't. So it didn't get into the ED, but I think it might live to find another day.
Martin?
Only one comment, because when I thought regarding this kind of accounting for these plans, an additional problem I think is okay that everything is now expense over the vesting period of this kind of transactions. And because what I have seen in practice, it is always okay two elements. It is a kind of retention element, because if you say have vesting conditions, say okay, you have to work for another 3-4 years. But also a big portion of why employees getting this kind of awards, it is because they regarding the performance in the past. And that was also, I think, the indication of that, because amounts people getting is regarding the performance what was achieved in the reporting year, so in the past. But everything is expensed in the future, and I think that is really, for me, always a big problem, and that leads to that, I think, when especially senior executives then maybe after 3 years have to expense that, but that was a really bad year, then people think, okay, why this guy is getting such high bonus, because the current year is so bad. Because it has to be expensed from maybe it was a successful year 3 years ago. And I think if we do something, I think we have to address also this issue. Because I think maybe the majority of these plans are really structured to have this retention element in, which then the objective is to get it expensed in the future and not really in the current year. And that, I think, is an additional issue which, just if we do something, we have to address.
Stephen, do you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond that this issue is not new. It's in the issue of continuous employment, like it exists in IFRS 3, and it does come up in practice all the time. But then, like, the pushback that auditors normally give, like, why is this condition in the contract in the first place, i.e. that the person should stay in employment, like, if it's expensive, it's substantive.
As I said, it is a retention element, but it's also an element of past performance. So it is both, and I think we, but only accounting for already this retention element.
But if the attribution aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if there is evidence that some of the reward relates to the past performance, then IFRS 2 does not prohibit to recognize it.
It is sufficient evidence, because if you work in a company you had six plans, say first looking what was your performance in the current year, and then this amount of bonuses attached to that. So that is the sufficient evidence that is related to past year's performance.
Stephen. I just wanted to agree with Martin. I think there are other ways to simplify IFRS 2 other than switching to reporting date accounting, and Martin, that would be one of them. It's interesting that you note many advantages of reporting date accounting, but there's no disadvantages.
No, there are. There is a paragraph. paragraph A6.
Sorry, paragraph
A6 on page 27. Actually, A5 and A6, two paragraphs.
So that's an advantage in A5.
Disadvantage.
Second sentence.
Both advantages and disadvantages.
The main conceptual disadvantage of this measurement pattern.
It includes conceptual disadvantage, and A6 includes practical disadvantage.
There's also the counterintuitive aspect of it.
It's not.
We had difficulty with fair valuing own debt because of the counterintuitive effects. We ended up putting it in OCI. Do you not think that a reporting date accounting would effectively bring the same problem, but bring it to share-based payments?
Not at all. I don't see how reporting date fair value for IFRS 2 or for share-based payments can produce counterintuitive results. If share prices increase and employees get higher bonuses, I don't see how it is counterintuitive. But I think like what people often find counterintuitive is like if the share prices increase, but the grant date fair value is very low, but that's more counterintuitive.
But I think people who have problems with accounting for NCI puts, for example, would agree with that argument, the counterintuitive argument. Mm.
I guess it's how we looked at
it. I think it'll be an argument that will be raised by many if we go down a reporting date route.
So one of the issues that you didn't tackle in here that I'm not necessarily suggesting that we go whole hog into, but I've always found somewhat counterintuitive to use that expression, and I thought Ian was going to elaborate on this, but I just wanted to raise the point that in the conceptual framework, and this is a discussion, an ongoing discussion I have with Peter a lot, we have a statement in paragraph, conceptual framework ED, we have a statement that says equity claim does not contain an obligation to transfer economic resources. Furthermore, an equity claim is not an economic resource for the issuer. It follows that an obligation of an entity to transfer its own equity claims to another party is not an obligation to transfer an economic resource. Okay? So then why do we debit the profit and loss statement when we issue an equity claim to a counterparty that is a employee, not necessarily a current shareholder, for services rendered? Why do we take the debit side through P&L if this statement is true?
But we also explain that in the conceptual framework ED as we do in the basis for IFRS 2. We say that conceptually the entity has received an asset from the counterparty, which they've immediately consumed.
So then why is it equity then? When you granted this instrument to the employee as opposed to an existing shareholder? In other words, to my mind, there's a bit of a conflict there. And so the point I thought Ian was going to suggest is that another way of looking at this is that this charge shouldn't necessarily go through P&L. It could go through some kind of an expanded statement of changes in equity. I think that hangs together better with the concept embedded in 4.3.
You're going back to the very basis of the original.
Absolutely, there's no question.
And Gary was raising the same.
But I'm just saying that if you go down this path, so the reason why I bring this up, to your point, Nadia, is I think it's important that we nail down and come to an agreement on where we're going on the conceptual framework. And I think it's worthy of talking about this in the context also of our debt equity project as well, and reconcile, square all three of these, and not leave one hanging out here, share-based payments, and just do debt equity claims and the conceptual framework. Because I actually think there's a rationale here that we have to square.
Well, I must say to Peter that your point about getting an asset and converting it actually isn't in the paper. There's a point there where you could put it in, but it's not in this paper at the moment. Mary.
And I just wanted to go back to one point, which is, you know, my joke about therapy. If you put something in front of people and say, the subject is IFRS 2, we have an hour and a half to please discuss, we all bring out the problems and how we think we would approach them and how nice it would be to get everything lined up conceptually. But I think we have to remember with research projects, the fundamental question is, given the cost of a project, given the cost of change, are the problems such that we prioritize this over other things that are competing, not just for our time, but also for our stakeholders' time and capacity for change? And so the fact that when we gather together, we can throw up all kinds of ideas and identify and feel better because we've gotten out of our system where we think there are anomalies, inconsistencies, problems, I think we shouldn't then kind of roll forward without sanity checking ourselves to say, but should we do something about it? So let's not confuse the therapy process with the decision-making process.
I don't want to do a sanity check on ourselves.
I agree completely with what Mary just said, but I wonder whether some of the points that have been raised today, we should think about whether they should be built into this, if that's something that's going to end up as a sort of record of thoughts.
They can certainly be in the notes of this meeting, but they could also go into an eventual paper. Any other comments? Nadia, anything you want to raise?
I look forward to our discussion in March. We all have responses, and hopefully you'll have time to digest our discussion on the paper. And we'll come to discussion until you come to conclusion.
Well, thank you very much, and well done. Why don't we break until 10 o'clock?
Okay. Cool.